This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
My name is Judith Stein. I am a member of the board of the ICA USA. We are an affiliated society of CAA and each year present a panel, or have for quite a while. The Art Critics Association has not a terribly long history, but it came into being as an NGO after the Second World War, the spin-off from the United Nations in the aftermath of the war with all of the systems broken. It was a way to encourage criticism to get back on track. So today there are over 60 chapters in countries around the world, and the American chapter is the largest one with 400 members. We are, almost all of us, hyphenated in our identities. So there are artists slash critics, or our historians slash critics, or blog posters versus academics, or there's any way that you can imagine. That's the diversity of our membership. So it was with some thought that we put together this panel, calling it Fluid Edge: Art Criticism Beyond Compliance. There are three panelists, and I think I'll introduce them, and then I will step back. I will turn the program over to Aaron Levy.
As Judith alluded to, the very identity of this panel has shifted a bit over the past few months. A little bit over 6 months ago, as we began to conceptualize it, we imagined that this would be a forum for discussing the relationship between art criticism and art history. A lot's been written and said about this relationship. This relationship seems as vexed as ever, and we wanted to unpack that. In the ensuing months, however, in response to the larger socio-political conversations that were happening in the United States about equality and justice, but also our own changing conversations about art criticism today, and in particular, a comment by Tom Finkelpearl, New York City's Commissioner of Cultural Affairs, previously the director of the Queens Museum, at a recent ICA Awards ceremony about the need to diversify the art critic and reimagine the art critic, we started to think that maybe we ought to rethink this panel. And so what we ended up doing was retitling it, but also reimagining it as a forum not about the art critic or the art historian in crisis or in division, but rather to kind of imagine the art critic perhaps as a fluid agent that can move across social, political, and geopolitical topics and trajectories. The art critic is one who ought to be or is responsive to the times and helping us navigate those times. With that in mind, I want to just begin with a short clip by Devin Allen, who couldn't be here. Devin's commanding photographs of the Baltimore Uprising have been really inspiring and empowering for many. He also represents a sort of photo activist, one who, together with other photographers and activists in Baltimore, is trying to enable conversation about social systems, not just about photography, per se. And so I thought that might be like an apt way to begin, to talk about his perspective on art criticism as a young artist working in an inner city.
No one knew who I was until the image of Tom, but when Tom saw my work, they said, "Your work has been good. And you're an amateur, why doesn't anyone know about you?" And that's because I lack the connection to people who write about art. It's a certain type of disconnection nowadays. So when people can't get those connections, people like us, we usually use social media to get our work seen. So there we're basically skipping the journalists and people like that. I think as a critic, you know, you have a voice, you have a certain type of power that an up-and-coming artist doesn't have. You know, you can really, if you dig deep enough, you can find the next Basquiat, you know, the next Gordon Parks. I only can imagine if a critic was critiquing my work and knew and was writing about me before time, how powerful my images before then would have been. You know, I definitely didn't need to be more in the community, not just writing. You know, they need to be on the front line. So when there is a young underground art scene, They should be running that art scene. They should be breaking down barriers with these young artists. They should be controlling that narrative, telling people like, look, I have this young artist from Baltimore, from Philly, from New York that no one knows, but I'm telling you he's the next big thing. They should be breaking careers and not writing about what has passed and gone already. They should be, even if as a critic, if you're 50 years old, find you a 21-year-old, 18-year-old artist and walk the streets with them, go get a coffee with them, see where they hang out, what type of music they listen to, because this new scene, it moves fast. You know, with social media, it's way more content in the world than the 80s and the 90s. Now we have the internet and everyone takes to the internet. So you need to control the narrative. And I think that these art critics should be the ones hosting art shows. You know, when these young artists don't have a platform, give them a platform because you have the voice. Control the narrative of this next generation. The most important part with any critic or any journalist, any type of artist in general, is about changing with the times and not becoming stagnant. You know what happens with stagnant water? You know, it gets bacteria and then it's, you don't want to touch it. You know, and that's how I feel about people who stuck in that one pocket. I don't want to touch it. Art critics are supposed to grow with the times, evolve. You are the voice of the community. If you're growing with the times, you can understand the social change, the change inside the community. If you're writing about a black artist, understand the history. As an example, me, you understand where I come from, but you also understand the history of Baltimore, the heroin, the drugs, all the issues Baltimore have, and you can understand why I went through the trials and tribulations what led me to becoming a photographer. But if you know the past, present, and future, not only that, but you're growing. You're learning from me just like I'm learning from you. That's what it's all about. As a critic, as a writer, people should not just have to go to publications for you. You should be writing daily. You know, you should be on social media daily because people turn to you to know what's next. That's what evolving is about. I feel like a lot of critics are dinosaurs. They stuck to the old ways, and don't get me wrong, I love traditional ways. But at the same time, implement those traditional ways onto the present and grow with it. About my boy D. Watkins, who's a journalist, author. One thing I can say about him and what he's perfected, he's very good at it, is even though he's writing about the community and documenting and everything else, and he writes for some paper, city paper, but he's still on the ground with us. We're hand in hand. You know, that's the type of person that if I needed something or if I get locked up or anything protesting, he would be there to save me or try to in any type of way. He's been an anchor for the community, for the young black artist that's coming up. It's a certain type of companionship that he gives to all of us, not just me, but to Kwan Duani, who's an amazing spoken word artist, or Kwame Rose, who's a social activist. But he's connected through all of us because he's in the community, but he also helps all of us. The people turn to him, but they come to us. He's like our filter. So he does a lot for the community, and he's a perfect example of a person that changes with the times because he's much older. He's older than I am. And it's just a certain type of, it's hard to describe, but when you have a person that's a peer, but he's on a totally different battlefield than you, his world is different from you, but he can come into your world and he can understand your world, but then go back and articulate your world like it's his world. And that's what he does so well. You have an event, he will come. He's not going to just, you know, come and interview you and say, tell me how the event went. No, he's going to come, still interview you, but get and seek for himself and then come to his own conclusion. And that's what I feel a lot more art critics and people come from behind that desk and don't just call me over the phone or call people over the phone and talk to them. No, hop on that plane. Get into it. Get your hands dirty.
So I wanted to begin with this very moving and very provocative series of comments by Devin Allen, because I think what he says has a lot of validity, but I also wanted to begin with an artistic voice, and I wanted our conversation to be responsive to an artistic perspective. I wanted to briefly recapitulate some of the salient points that I took from Devin Allen's remarks before I turn it over to Jonathan and Philip to take the conversation in another direction. First, I think his concern is that criticism is not changing with the times sufficiently. I think fundamentally he's also concerned about a disconnect between artists, critics, but also society more generally. I think this disconnect can be measured both sociopolitically, but also generationally and even aesthetically. So I think he's asking us to pay attention to that disconnect and to negotiate and work through it. In so doing, he's hoping that we will recalibrate and reimagine that relationship in particular between the artist and the critic, hoping that the critic will also function as he does as an artist to break down barriers, barriers across race, class, institutionality, and together to construct a more diverse community and a diverse kind of artistic community in particular. I think that he's also asking the critic to recognize that there's been a sea change in how artists make work, particularly among younger generations. Today, artists do not just make objects, but they also construct social relationships. There's a long history of this, but I think it's particularly foregrounded today, and he's asking the critic to be responsive to that, not just to attend spectatorial kind of counters such as exhibitions, but also to understand the social life of the artist more generally. So just as artists are exhibiting their work and performing their work, constructing their work in new ways, so too we need to reimagine our critical methods. Ultimately, he hopes that this will construct greater resilience within the cultural community, both for critics and artists, but also enable greater solidarity. So with that, I wanted to turn to Jonathan and Philip, and I've already kind of shared with them some of these perspectives and my own commitment to a very fluid conception of a critic. But I wanted to pose just three questions at the outset, and then we will go wherever we so choose. First of all, does the critic today have the ability and the agency that Devin thinks that they do and that they should see themselves as having? What sort of agency does the critic have? In the preparatory kind of material for this panel, I had invoked a comment by the esteemed sociologist Zygmunt Bauman and his discussions in particular of modernity being a particular time marked by fluidity and liquidity. In his work on liquid modernity, he talks about this being a moment of unprecedented freedom for all of us, where we are all critics today. Everybody has become a critic. But even as we recognize that unprecedented freedom that we may have, it's also a moment of unprecedented impotence. And so I guess I'm interested in what sort of agency, again, the critic has. What sort of freedom do we have, but also what are our challenges? What sort of impotence do we face? And then the two other questions, how ought the critic to respond to this digital era that Devin invokes, one that has been incredibly disruptive, that challenges disciplinarity, that challenges institutional structures and social hierarchies, but also social systems. Today, so much seems fragile and in flux, not just social systems, but also our very understanding of the arts, their place in society. So how should the critic respond to this? Should they welcome these disruptions? Should they buttress themselves against them? Should they resist them? And then finally, is the critic still a specialized profession? Is everyone a critic? Ultimately, do we agree or disagree with Zygmunt Bauman's suggestion that democratization has brought us to this moment where everybody is a critic, but also it's diluted in a way, the power and the force of the critic? So these are just some opening questions. What will follow is a conversation, an extemporaneous one.
In listening to Devin, I sort of wish Devin was here, because I'd like to ask him a few questions about what he said. And probably the first question I would ask is whether or not it's a critic to whom he's seeking access or some other conduit to a wider audience. What particularly is advantageous about having a critic in this closer relationship to artists? The reason I ask that is that I can see, in fact, I saw Devin's work do this extraordinary jump from Baltimore to Time Magazine. You know, if we want to talk about the enormous changes that we're seeing in social media and the internet and how that's changed the profession, 100,000 Instagram followers, I would give anything for 100,000 Instagram followers. So in a sense, I kind of wonder about my power as a critic to do the things he kind of would like me to do. Maybe he's thinking about somebody else besides me. Maybe he's thinking about a journalist who can go into the field and be with him and understand the larger context of his work, but not come encumbered with the obligation, maybe it's a dinosaur's obligation, but it still encumbers me, to be independent, to maintain my distance, to be careful of the social relationships I cultivate as a critic. So I agree with a lot of what he says. I kind of wonder if maybe I'm not the right person.
It's very interesting. I have a good friend who's a critic in Buffalo, and it's a complicated relationship because, in fact, we're not really good friends at all. There's constantly, as you suggest, walls coming down at every point. I say, let's go have a coffee. Well, I really can't do that. that wouldn't be fair. I understand that hesitancy, but I also think that in some sense, every generation of artists has always had its explainers, its critics. This is not new, and what he's asking for is not new. Leo Steinberg did this for Jonathan Rauschenberg. Lucy Lepard did this in the 60s. This is, in part, what we look to critics, in fact, what we look to lasting criticism to do, which is to take a moment still wet behind the ears and help us understand what's at stake. And that does entail, no question about it, being close to artists. In fact, it involves, it seems to me, and a challenge to the idea of objectivity itself. And I realize that this is a key term in the critical vocabulary, but I would want to put pressure on that term and ask what it actually means, and to what extent is the deployment of in quotes, objectivity merely a reification of an authoritative voice that is comfortable in newspapers. And I guess I would finally want to say that vis-a-vis the medium itself, that I pity American critics because I get to read newspapers from other countries where criticism is a much more lively art and where actually a critic can engage, you know, a full page with substantive historical critique, whereas now so often it's passing judgment on a particular exhibition, decontextualized, and often these very short thumbnails. What I guess I'm asking is, what happens when when critics approach the condition of artists, when they share a perspective, articulate a shared critique, and is that a compromising of anything? To me, it's not. It is an invested, ideologically self-aware act of moving close to an artist in order to see and understand through their eyes.
Well, you raised the question of objectivity, and you want to push back on that. So I'd like to push back on pushing back a little bit and understand a little bit more of what a legitimate, non-objective kind of criticism would be. I think of it in very practical terms. I think of it in terms of seeing myself at a dinner table with friends who are artists, and knowing that there are certain things I will not say to them because of the social pressure, because of the breach of a friendship that would come from that. I think that operates. I don't think that one can just set that aside in hopes of finding a new model of embeddedness. You know, there's always going to be a suspicion between people who are speaking on behalf and about versus the people who are simply making and doing. You know, when I think about Devin's work, there are a lot of questions I would ask if I were writing about it that I'm actually glad he's not here because I can ask them. For instance, is his work primarily journalistic or is it primarily artistic? Now, that would be a category he probably wouldn't necessarily want to talk about. Having the freedom of not being necessarily in the same room or the same bench or at the same dinner table with the artist lets me do that. So I'm trying to ask, what does it look like to operate as a critic independently but without the objectivity or the freedom from those kinds of very practical, real, very emotional pressures?
I totally understand that. And I think it would be terribly socially awkward to befriend an artist and ask hard and complicated questions, but that is, in fact, the job description. So I suppose what I'm advocating is a very close relationship to artists that doesn't preclude one from asking the hard questions, but that also looks askance at a guise of objectivity itself, because surely by this point we know we don't have that, we can't have that. All we can have is the narrow focus of our own right relationship. So we acknowledge our ideological biases, and we acknowledge other people's ideological biases, but we can't ever claim to be, of course, rid of them. I wonder if part of what the digital explosion is about is a refusal of those standards of objectivity, and a recognition, a political recognition, that the omniscient voice can no longer and should no longer function.
I want to continue this conversation, but also add a different reading of what I think Devin is proposing. I think he's calling our attention to how we are socialized and habituated to not talk to so many people in society. Art critics are socialized, I don't mean this critically to you, to find it almost like an encumbrance, a limit on one's objectivity, to talk to the artist, to socialize with the artist. But so too today, I think we're also cognizant in a larger social sense how much we are socialized to not talk to people that are of different classes or races. So I think that he's in a way asking us in 2016 to in a way maybe he's not so much interested in the historical relation between the critic and the artist or the critic and the historian, but rather to see in 2016 that there's a need for a solidarity, and that solidarity perhaps comes back to this earlier comment of yours, is this a form of activism or journalism or artistic production? I think for him there's a fluidity that he sees in his work, but that he also sees in the potential of the critic to build greater solidarity in society. I think for him, coming from Baltimore, Baltimore is a divided city, and he thinks, I think, that the critic is a crucial element in a way that maybe comes back to your work and your interest in activism and in queer activism. The critic here becomes kind of a challenge to normative conceptions of criticism. The critic has the potential to help us think questions that we wouldn't think through otherwise.
Exactly. I mean, I find... naming names, I am constantly torn asunder by Holland Cotter's criticism, because on questions of race and questions of gender, he's one of the best there is, but on questions of sexuality, he's not. And as a gay man, as a gay critic, I find that very difficult to understand how a gay critic can be, in some sense, so blind to questions of sexuality. I want him to be more of an advocate than he is. And I often find that I want my critics to own something deep and political and engaged that is connected to their own perception of the world, to not in any way obscure that fact, but to use that as the beam along which all of their criticism, right, in the way that, again, Lucy or Steinberg did at another historical moment.
Can I push back? No, I'm not sure. Push back, maybe even push forward. We were talking about objectivity, and by objectivity, I don't want to pretend that there's a sort of golden platform from which I can pontificate with no questions of biases or politics or anything like that. That's not all. I think of it, as I said before, very much in practical terms. I know my own comfort and discomfort levels and the social pressures and so on, and I think there's a value to maintaining that. I think there's a value to maintaining a kind of criticism that hasn't been co-opted by art, that's not merely an appendage or an adjunct to art. On the other hand, if we're talking about how the new media world is changing criticism, one of the very practical and from my point of view actually sort of great things that's happened is that the production of text at newspapers is so voluminous now that the gatekeeping function is much less than it was 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. So when it comes to the degree to which I can own my own politics, and in fact, my politics are very much coming out of the fact that I'm a you know, middle-aged gay white guy. You know, I've got that. It's clear. A lot of, if you read my writing carefully, you can probably detect that. They used to beat that out of me. Now they don't even have time for it. And that's a relief. And I've gone to my editors and other people around the newspaper and said, what are the new rules here? You know, I mean, I notice in other places that there's a lot more politics, there's a lot more activism creeping into writing. I'd like to do that. Am I allowed to? And they don't actually really have a consistent answer to this. I think for the most part, the answer is that they can't control the flow anymore. So you're free, actually, not necessarily to just change what you're doing or change your sense of attitude, your ethics, but to create a voice that's comfortable for you.
And I would say that that is exactly the right direction, and that if more and more newspapers could be fields of contestatory voicings, right, in which we could come to understand something by discord, by cacophony, then we will have been well served.
I think they are. I mean, if I look at how the Washington Post covers art right now, I can go on the Post website and find four or five people who may be writing about the same art that I've written about from completely different perspectives. This will raise a question we want to bring up later. I will say, well, they're not the critic. But they're writing about it, and they're different voices. And 5-10 years ago, I might have gone to my editor and said, well, who is this person? Why are they, you know, stepping onto my territory? Now I realize it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter, because the only thing that matters to the Post is how I can sell my particular stories. And there's no competition from anybody else. It's all won or lost on your own individual ability to put a voice and a story out there.
Mm. I wanted to throw out another topic or trope. You had invoked the word co-optation in the title of the revised title for this panel. We had invoked the word compliance. Maybe the kind of dirty bedfellow to co-optation and compliance is complicity. And I guess I'm interested, are we at risk of being as critics kind of co-opted or too close to the artist, or is it rather social systems that we should have, that we should really critically examine? A number of critics, Christopher Knight and more grassroots critics, have talked about this, continue to write about this. But I'm interested in kind of the ubiquity of the Biennale, of the art fair, and our relative silence with regard to these systems, and in particular the way that they fetishize discrete authors, discrete artists, and whether we ought to shift our focus and not just write about artists, but also write critically about these systems and our complex and ambivalent relationship to them, and how much they overdetermine not just the arts, but the cultural ecology more generally.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, I think we first thing, we fetishize, right, the proper name, so criticism is unfortunately chained to a proper name far too often, and thus arguments about critical tendencies get lost. Arguments about critical failures get lost. And that's a problem, because that's where a lot of the real meat is, right? And as you suggest, also very much so, with the whole system of biennales and of course the role of money and all of this. None of this gets talked about. There is, I think, I mean, I'd like to hear from you, because it seems to me that there are inherent limits to what critics can do employed by newspapers, precisely because newspapers are complicated fora. They have investments. They do have to keep peace with advertisers. They don't want to be in a position of shooting themselves in the foot. And I wonder to what extent the idea of freedom is genuinely absolute. And that's a genuine question. I don't know.
No, it's a good question. From the outside, it seems a more problematic question from the inside. I can count on the fingers of one hand the number of times where I've felt that maybe something I'm saying or trying to say is pushing up against internal pressures like that. It happens extremely rarely. I think more problematic right now, especially since newspapers have become financially fraught, is that critics are really isolated from the mainstream of the art world at this point. I'm not in Basel. I'm not in Miami. You know, I'm lucky if I can get to New York 5 or 6 times a year. That's simply the pressures of the budgets going on. So when it comes to writing about those systems, I'm doing it at a remove. I think there's more writing about that than you're acknowledging. I think that if you wait until the next painting sells for a record price, and you'll see basically every critic across this country be compelled by their editors to write something about this travesty, and they'll all write a reasonably good piece about where this is leading us, and the problems with the market, and the corruption of art, and so on. We're aware of that. We don't, however, really circulate in the world that I think, what was the term, hyphenated? That sort of hyphenated world of the curator critic, the curator scholar. The rules, maybe they're old-fashioned, but the rules prevent us from taking money to go and be in those places. The rules prevent us from curating shows in those places. So what happens is we stay home.
I wonder, well, two things. First thing, I wonder if we could insert into this paradigm a distinction between newspapers and art magazines, because I think art magazines are, frankly, much more compromised. Their pages are entirely, or almost entirely, right, museums, galleries. And so I've always found, on the rare occasion when I'm asked to write for an art magazine, I always find pushback. They are always softening my prose. They're always trying to get me not to say what I want to say. And I find, as a consequence, that they're deeply conservative, even banal. And there are rare exceptions to this, but the mainstream journals, Art Forum Shortly, Art in America, are both, I think, highly homogenist and kind of, they tell us where the critical orthodoxy is today. But I also wonder, if it is a problem to be close to the artist. I wonder if it's a problem, and I ask this genuinely, to take money to go see an exhibition. In other words, to what extent, I mean, there's an assumption, right, that if you take money to go to an exhibition, you're going to be soft on that exhibition in a way that you wouldn't if you didn't take money. But I wonder if that's actually true. And I wonder, moreover, whether, in fact, one could be extremely close to an artist, see the world through their eyes, and still find the ability to critique it, to note its blindnesses.
I think you can. I mean, I think you can write absolutely brilliantly about artists that you're very close to. I think those pieces belong in The New Yorker. I think they belong in the popular press. I'd love to read them. I also think I can take money and not be influenced. But then when I try and extrapolate out to the larger world besides art, I think about the political candidate who says they took this money and of course it doesn't affect my vote. But we're not idiots. I mean, you know, over time, of course it affects you. It may not affect you in the moment that you're taking the money. It may not affect you where you're on that trip. But it affects you in the way you structure your career. And it's going to affect your language eventually.
I wanted to insist on this question of where the critical disposition is to be found. And I know that I've already made this point, but what I heard in Devin's remarks was that we perhaps could be judging something different than the artist. Perhaps we should, again, be judging the systems that produce the artists, that habituate us to think of artists in particular ways. And I think this is, in a way, a very traditional art historical question. We don't necessarily isolate the artist. We understand the artist to be kind of embedded within a social, political, economic context. And when we conduct our art historical scholarship, we understand the artist to be in dialogue with that context. And we are critiquing not so much the artist exclusively, but perhaps the context from which they arise. And so I guess I wanted to pose the question again, even though we've already been talking about it. Like, where do you think the critical disposition ought to be found today? We know that we keep going back to the artist, keep judging the artist, but are there other places that we could locate the critical disposition?
But your question, I think, cuts to the heart, which is, to what extent is criticism a profession as distinct from, say, art history? And I've always been confused by the distinction. I think of, essentially, art critics not as people who pass judgment, this is good, this is bad, but as the poor schmuck on the front lines of history who has to take the body blows. The luxury of being the art historian is that you can take a longer view and you're not required to respond immediately. You have more time to do the necessary historical and theoretical work. To answer your question, I think it is absolutely implicit on us to understand the broader social and historical context out of which work emerges. That's what I mean about being close to the artists. It's not intended to be a purely biographical account. It's intended to begin to understand the world through their perspective, and in generalizing that perspective, to come to understand how they see, to learn to see yourself. And what I'm particularly interested in is exactly that kind of standpoint epistemology. And I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that in some sense, that kind of standpoint epistemology is the new frontier of criticism, precisely because it has the distinct benefit of addressing and giving voice to those who have been too often made voiceless.
I agree with almost all of that. I mean, however, I think we might divide the present from the past a little bit. And certainly it's part of what I do, or what I hope to do when I write about art, especially art of the past, to talk about the social context, talk about historical forces. That's an obligatory part of explaining a show at the National Gallery or the Smithsonian. When you get to the present moment, these forces become a different matter because they haven't been processed for us. They haven't been named. They're elusive and shifting. So it's a harder thing to do. So what are the legitimate forms of research and entry into learning about those things that you have at your disposal? I'm not sure befriending the artist is the only route to get to those things, especially when it's a particular artist. I mean, you can befriend this artist and not that artist, and you can get some sense of the generalized perspective of the artist. So I think that sort of research is going to happen in a lot of different ways, not necessarily by having the critic sort of embedded within the exact same social context from which the art is emerging.
But can you note, as a critic, not just, as it were, in a positivist way, what's going on, but also what's not going on? And that's what I'm talking about, you know, the National Gallery in this town is one of the most reactionary institutions I have ever seen. And it is a crime. I'm waiting for someone to call out the National Gallery for the kinds of exhibitions they do, the vast sums of money they pour into this, and of course, specifically for what they don't do. And I'm just wondering to what extent criticism can be much more actively involved in engendering a different art world than the one we now assume?
Well, that's a really hard question, because if there's somebody who should be doing it, that's me. And to a certain extent, you know, I have, and my predecessors have. I mean, the subject of the representation of women at the National Gallery is a scandal, and it's a perennial one. We've talked about it. The Guerrilla Girls have engaged with this. I mean, we're aware of this. On the other hand, it's the main institution in town, and if one is in a combative relationship with them all the time, then there's a lot of stuff that gets sucked into that maw that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with it, and can you be objective about it? There's that word again. I've been in pretty fraught relationships with some institutions in the city precisely for what they don't and should be doing. I think there are franchises of the Smithsonian which are scandalously underutilized and have trivial agendas, and I can hit back at them. By temperament, I don't necessarily want to be the skunk at the party every single time I walk into a museum. That's another example of what I was saying from the beginning, and I'm copping to it right here. That's the everyday practical social pressure of being a critic working in a context.
And I understand that, but as speaking as the skunk at the party, right, this has always been, for me, one of the big issues. When the Johns retrospective happened and, you know, queerness was wiped out, when all the ways in which the museums uphold the most conservative standard and nobody ever calls them out on it. And, of course, they feel free then to do that precisely because there apparently are no consequences. I have to say, I have a show now called Art Aids America that's traveling, and when it was supposed to go to the Corcoran, when I heard that the National Gallery took over the Corcoran, I said to my husband, they're going to cancel the show. Two days later, the letter arrived canceling the show. So, of course, you know, and that's the way they operate, and we should know this, but the problem is that we know this, but the public doesn't know this.
Well, let me ask you a question. Why didn't you send me that when it happened? I could have gone to bat. I could have made a really big stink about that. Would you have been comfortable with my making that?
Oh, yeah. Really? That wouldn't. That's interesting. I don't know why I didn't send it.
Well, you can still send it.
Yeah, I can still send it to you.
Yeah, I should. I mean, the reason I ask the question is not to put you on the spot necessarily, but to say that, you know, there's a lot of that stuff that I'm not privy to. The Corcoran is a particular scandal, and it has been a nightmare, not just for me, but for the reporters of the paper, to get inside and figure out what's been going on there. And a lot of that has to do with not the unwillingness of the critic to cross the threshold and be on the other side and talk, but actually the people on the other side willing to come to us and tell us what's happening.
No, that's true.
I hear a fluid edge between criticism now and investigative journalism. I wanted to throw out the word crisis. As I began to prepare for this panel, I started to review prior public programming around art criticism, the state of art criticism, but also scholarly work on it. Ica had a panel at Tate Britain in 2011 entitled "The Art Critic in a Cold Climate." There was another panel at the ICA London the same year, The Trouble with Criticism. And the word crisis is frequently invoked. The only time that it hasn't been invoked in my quick and cursory review of recent activity was in a 2015 conference at the Walker Art Center entitled Superscript, Arts, Journalism, and Criticism in a Digital Age. You can download the transcript on the web, and it's quite fantastic and wide-ranging. So I guess I'm interested in hearing your thoughts about whether the critic is in crisis or whether this is a really unproductive and non-generative way to understand this contemporary moment. I, as you know, am mapping out a fairly expansive potentiality for the critic here aligned with almost community organizing and artistic activism. How does crisis resonate with you? Is it a helpful term? If we are in a state of crisis, what ought we do about that? And if we're not, what might be the trope or the theme or the word that you would use to describe this current moment?
Should we get the ugly part out of the word first? Yeah, okay. I mean, look, we all know Elkin's book, and the important thing in that is his division of criticism into a lot of different things. I mean, we're talking about criticism a bit monolithically here. When it comes to the kind of criticism I do, it is absolutely 100% in crisis, and it's terrifying. I don't know if anybody who was here at the presentation at 9:30, there was another panel on criticism. If so, pardon me for repeating myself. But when the Washington Post redesigned its headquarters and moved into a new building, they created this enormous digital panel that runs almost two floors. This panel shows you in real time how many people are reading which stories. And it runs. So 91,414 people are reading this, down to 89,217. And there are people whose entire job is to sit and move things around on the website to keep those numbers humming along at the maximum place that you can get them. There is no future for art criticism such as I do it if that is used to judge the performance of individual writers. There's no way that I can survive doing what I do. My numbers will never hit 89,000, 90,000, 91,000 in that kind of moment-by-moment ticking off. Now,
Unless you write about this.
And that's exactly the pressure. I mean, I know how to get those numbers there. And it's to write about things that are controversial. It's to write about the Renoir found in the basement. It's to write about the highest selling bacon. That's what gets the numbers. I have no interest in doing that. The market, writing about the market as a kind of perpetual ongoing train wreck is not fun or interesting. Now, the only upside to the current moment is that critics like me never sold newspapers. I mean, back when newspapers were sold with advertising and you had a circulation of 500,000 or 800,000, it was not the art critic who was making the money for the paper. So criticism, such as I practice it, has always been at the sufferance of a relatively enlightened publisher who figures that it's important either for his own social relations or for an enlightened view of the world to have arts criticism. So maybe nothing's changed. But if that ability to measure moment by moment what people are reading, which is directly connected to the amount of money a newspaper can make moment by moment, if that's applied to me, it's over.
But let me ask you, seriously, if you were to, for example, write strongly about the exclusions at the National Gallery, wouldn't that change your numbers? And is that a bad thing to do then? I mean, it certainly, from my perspective, ought to be said.
It will, maybe, if I hit the particular nerve of the moment. And I do. I mean, this is part of the staple of what I write. I mean, I've written on, representation of homosexuality. And obviously, in the years after Hide and Seek, that's been a subject. And it has been a subject that's gained a lot of traffic. I also like writing about art, from time to time. And that's what really drove me to it. It's really, that's my passion. And although I realize that you can't necessarily separate art from those questions, there is a satisfaction that comes from writing about just what's in a wall or on the floor or in front of you as an aesthetic object. And so to write perpetually about, the scandal of what's happening in the art world, while that may pump your numbers, it's not necessarily a satisfying diet intellectually.
Can we hear more about what Aaron is talking about in terms of community activism, art criticism? That's what I heard you say, and I'd like to know more about what you're doing. You're writing that way, I presume, as a critic, and I don't know very much about you, so yeah. I wondered if you'd indulge me by telling me more.
Well, I'm going to do so in a slightly indirect way, but I do want to talk about this. I think what's at stake in my suggestion that there could be an alliance between, let's say, activism as we've traditionally understood it, and organizing. I guess what I'm trying to get at is that there's a need. I think Devin Allen speaks about this. I think Tom Finkelpearl in his 2015 remarks that I alluded to before in an ICA event alluded to. I think there's a need to diversify our perspectives and to diversify what we value and how we value it and what role art criticism plays in that. In particular, I'm really interested in how we foreground perspectives that are not our own as critics, as scholars, as artists, as curators.
Are you writing art criticism?
Yes, so in a way, to be more precise, to be more particular, Devin Allen seems to kind of propose the critic as medium, right? He almost functions in a Boisean way, in a shamanistic way, as one who will be kind of channeling the zeitgeist of the times, but also be this conduit through which a community, particularly a marginalized community, is able to enunciate and speak. So I don't know if we want to critically interrogate that, but what I am interested in is his notion that the critic ought to maybe not just write in the first person, or at least not foreground their own positionality and their own perspectives. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about this, the notion of the critic not just foregrounding their perspective, their judgment on social systems, on artistic practices, but the critic foregrounding other perspectives and constantly decentering themselves through exposure to artists, institutions, practices more generally. And if this is something that you guys would agree with, or if you think that we need to hold on to the kind of criticism as it's been traditionally understood, or as I'm maybe perhaps reductively thinking of it as traditionally understood.
You want to start? Because my answer is kind of predictable in this regard.
I think of the word curiosity. I mean, isn't that a kind of continual decentering in a way? I mean, I'm curious about things. I'm curious about things that are not like me. That's why I'm interested in art. That's why I'm interested in history. It's why I read. So is curiosity enough? I mean, does that get to what we're talking about? Can that be a sufficient drive to bring in other perspectives? I mean, I hope so. It feels like it's been, a fairly good motivator for me. You're using a slightly different language, though, than curiosity. Curiosity is a fairly everyday sort of word. So tell me a little bit more about whether or not that's sufficient to get us to where you think we should be in that sense.
I guess I'm interested in to talk about curiosity like Foucault's conception of curiosity, something that destabilizes fixed hierarchies, that resists conventional conceptions of knowledge. I guess I'm thinking of maybe a fluid edge between art criticism. I know I'm constantly invoking new fluid edges, but a fluid edge between, let's say, art criticism and ethnography. Could you ever anticipate your editors allowing you, or would you want to pen a piece that also foregrounded other voices that you were not necessarily translating, but that you were also foregrounding? And I guess to come back to the question that you had posed, Devin, Alan and I have been writing together, and I've been trying to figure out how I can write together with others at the table or digitally mediated, but to not just write in the first person or to not just write in isolation, physically or psychologically, and to see writing as the mechanism for reestablishing a connection, but literally to collaboratively write. And I think that is what is happening all around us today in an era of Google Docs, where we, everybody is writing together, but can the art critic write together?
Well, I'll let Jonathan jump in really quickly, but I would say, yes, there are ways to do that. I wrote a piece that about an exhibition of Hispanic and Latino art at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. A artist critic, Alex Rivera, really hated what I said. There was a Facebook conversation about it. I thought it was a great conversation. I wrote to him and said, let's have the conversation. Let's do it in the Post. And we had a dialogue. We published it in the Post. It seems to me that's one way of doing it. Newspapers are always going to be fairly nervous and unsure about anything that doesn't fit the format that they're used to. But, the Washington Post has got some flexibility. And so, yeah, I think that is possible.
And of course, obviously I would suggest precisely this model that criticism shade into reportage. Number one, investigative journalism. Number two, and also avail itself of the wonderful opportunity to decenter one's perspectives through the voice of someone else, and especially someone else who comes from someplace else. So, yeah, where it gets complicated is that it doesn't get rid of the Brechtian problem, right? It becomes a complicated form of social change because it does both offer alternative perspectives, but to what extent that actually engenders an activist, right, social change is very much up for grabs. Does this appearing in a printed form give a reader the simulacrum of engagement with none of the messy reality of it?
I mean, does it dilute its radicality? It becomes a new form of leisure or entertainment.
Yes.
Yeah. That's up to the reader. I mean, in a sense, it's up to the reader to do something with what's put out there. I mean, maybe it will just be a simulacrum, maybe they'll treat it that way, but I can't necessarily get terribly concerned about the impotence of my writing because I can't force it in front of people. I can't force people to read it and then do something. I mean, in a sense, I would shift that responsibility on to the reader and the audience more than maybe even the critic.
Is there an ethical question as well to be found in kind of the project of now writing and passing through and moving through communities that are not your own? I don't know if that's something you want to talk about, but like, what might be the ethical implications of, let's say, passing as a critic?
Or even the most basic level, competency. I mean, if you are moving through something that is utterly foreign to your experience, how can you ascertain truth from falsehood? How can you really make a substantive claim knowing what you're talking about. That's one of the problems. That's why I think art historians have much more time to do this than critics do. And it may be, therefore, barking up the wrong tree. But I also think that maybe what we should be doing is, you know, talking about various kinds of criticism in which newspaper, right, traditional newspaper criticism is one genre, but there are lots of other critics doing lots of other kinds of criticism. And that is, in fact, a description of what's happening today.
One of the themes that was lurking, I think, in your introduction is sort of how the changing media landscape, how the changing social media and so on have changed things. You know, I mean, use the tools you have. Find the information where you can find it. One of the remarkable things about having Facebook friends or followers on Twitter is that, in fact, you have access to a lot more conversations that are going on. And those are useful. Those are valuable. One can kind of just hover and lurk and actually learn a lot without even necessarily even participating in them. You know, I have critic friends in India. I did not have that 10 years ago. I've never met them, but I'm following their dialogue. So, you know, I don't even have to leave my desk, and I can actually get access to some of those things.
There's this very complicated conversation to be had about how much fluidity or how much porosity we can handle, and how to navigate that landscape. I think this is like a really interesting question, and a question that we're forced to have by virtue of these digital disruptions. This is a complicated moment. On the one hand, it seems that social hierarchies are as entrenched as ever. Racial class hierarchies seem as entrenched as ever in 2015, 2016. At the same time, we are also cognizant of how destabilized things have become, particularly with the internet. So it's very interesting to think about how one constructs an identity in that fluid landscape, but that landscape that actually isn't always that fluid at all, that you thought was fluid. There's like a fluctuation, I think, between fluidity and solidity today. It's hard to figure out what social system we're living in and where we position ourselves in relationship to that flux.
But is it a question that it's difficult to form, to find an identity, or it's difficult to define a profession? I mean, I think what you're really talking about, it seems to me, is the question of the professional critic. And that may be, in fact, an endangered species. But I don't think that the project of a different kind of criticism is anywhere near at conclusion.
Or that it's in crisis.
Or that it's even in crisis. Yeah.
It's not the identity that's threatened by fluidity, but the professional status of the critic that's threatened by fluidity.
Yes.
Just as a final question, I think that all of us probably share a view that criticism is something that enables us not just to write about the world, but also to find ourselves. And it is a mechanism through which we articulate what we think and what we believe and what we live. As a critic, one is always recalibrating oneself in relation to what's happening. One also has to historicize where one began and what led to those changes.
Exactly. And one also has to ask other questions that are very hard to ask today. There are a number of works that address blackness that are not by black artists. To what extent does that figure into this equation? Is this fundamentally a numbers game? Is it about identities, or is it about identification, an active force? And can identification transcend racial differences? Can one, for example, as a white critic, address black experience?